This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, a first-hand account inside the Murdoch succession drama. Say the name Rupert Murdoch, and it conjures the enormously influential media empire he's created. From Fox News and the Wall Street Journal, to Dow Jones and HarperCollins, to the scores of tabloids and TV stations he's built across the world. And over the decades of his career, his name has also become synonymous with his extraordinary power as a conservative force in global media.
Rupert, through his newspapers, TV outlets, has the ability to make or break political careers, topple governments. And I think a lot of people would say that he played a large role in delivering Donald Trump to the White House.
That's McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. In his latest piece, McKay reminds us that for six people on the planet, Rupert Murdoch isn't just a powerful media mogul, he's also dad.
His family has become a point of fixation for many in the media because Rupert has always tried to draw his adult children into the family business.
Rupert is now 93 years old. And when he dies, four of his children, Prudence, Elizabeth, Lachlan, and James, will be in control of the family trust and the direction his news outlets will take in the future. But it almost didn't happen this way. Last year, Rupert attempted to change the trust, which resulted in a court battle that ruptured the family in a way that may be beyond repair.
I think it is a tragedy, and I think it's a cautionary tale. And we all live with the consequences in some ways of this family's dysfunction, but the dysfunction matters in its own right as well.
McKay spent much of the last year talking to Rupert's youngest son, James, as the court drama was playing out. This is a family that's been super close-lipped, very reluctant to talk to journalists about the behind-the-scenes of the family. But McKay says James wanted to share his perspective on his rivalry with his brother Lachlan, the eldest brother and current CEO of Fox, and the war for the family media empire. McKay also requested interviews with Rupert and Lachlan, but they declined. Their spokesperson took issue with some of the ways James characterized certain events, which McKay notes in his story. McKay started by telling me what built up to this moment and why James decided that now, one of the most painful times in his life, was the right time to take his narrative into his own hands.
Rupert stepped back and kind of quasi-retired in 2023. There was a lot of media focus on Lachlan, the oldest son, who had become the successor, the CEO and chairman of these companies. And I just had this kind of intuitive sense that the more interesting profile subject would be James, because James, the younger son, had been inside the companies for a long time, had seen a lot, had never really talked about it, but he had always been seen as kind of a black sheep to a certain extent within the Murdoch family. Mm. He had more, you know, moderate to liberal politics. When he was younger, he got piercings and tattoos and dropped out of Harvard to start a hip-hop label. And, you know, he didn't kind of conform to the Murdoch mold the way that certainly his older brother did. And as it turned out, and I didn't know this at the time, this was early 2024, his father had just done something that James and his sisters experienced as a kind of profound betrayal, which is that Rupert had decided at 92 years old to try to rewrite the irrevocable family trust in a way that would concentrate full control of the family empire with Lachlan and essentially disenfranchise his three other oldest children. The original plan had always been that when he was gone, control of the empire would be split equally among those four children. Rupert decided only Lachlan could be trusted as a steward of his legacy. And James was hurt by this, he was betrayed, and I think in a certain way was liberated. Mm. I think he felt like he didn't need to be bound by this kind of code of omerta that had defined the Murdoch family for so long. You know, you don't talk about the family outside of the family. You certainly don't talk to reporters. I think he felt like, I don't owe that to my dad anymore, and he told me kind of this remarkable story about everything he had seen inside the family business and about the unraveling of his own family.
Mm. One other thing that was so interesting about him as he was speaking to you, you know, he makes all of these literary references, these sort of big mythical references to stories, to real, I would say, tragedies. Mm. It seems like he's very self-aware that he is living a larger-than-life tragedy in a way.
Yeah, I think it's how he kind of processes this family trauma is by comparing it to or placing it in a kind of historical context. Like, he is almost a student of dynastic dysfunction. Like, he quotes King Lear in conversations, and he studies Roman emperors, and the story constantly has him referencing these things to the point where at one point in the editing process, one of the editors was like, should we cut some of this stuff? It kind of feels like it's like Classics Hour with James Murdoch, you know?
It's laid on a little thick. Yeah.
Yeah, but I wanted to keep it because I felt like it captured something about him, which was like he was uncomfortable sometimes with speaking directly about his own dad and his own family dynamics. That was the way that he could kind of connect with it, and it felt maybe a little bit more emotionally safe. Mm-hmm. But it also does, I think, to your point, capture the kind of sweeping Shakespearean nature of this story.
Well, speaking of sweeping stories, we can't really talk about the Murdochs without talking about the HBO show Succession, which so many people watched. I watched obsessively, you might say. And I think for so many people, including, it sounds like, people close to the family and even in the family, a lot of the show rang very, very true. Like, it hit very close to home for them, right?
Well, I will even say it was a weird experience as the reporter interviewing James, because he would tell me stories, and I would be like, man, that sounds so familiar. Like, are you sure you haven't told this story anywhere? And he'd say, no. And then I would realize, oh, there was a plot line in Succession exactly like this. And that was a phenomenon that actually played out throughout the Murdoch family for many years.
You've said that Rupert Murdoch is unusual in a way, in that he has really run his businesses with the assumption that it will remain a family-run business. It sounds like, though, Rupert wasn't a very active presence in the kids' lives, especially when they were young. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you tell me a little bit more about the foundations of their relationship when the kids were young? Like, what kind of father was he?
Yeah, and this is where I think different kids might have different stories to tell, right? James was the youngest of the four original children. And so I think he felt maybe not abandoned by his dad, but his dad was not like an active presence in his life, especially once he reached kind of adolescence. Rupert actually moved with James's mother to Los Angeles when James was a teenager, and he would go a long time without seeing his dad. James stayed back in Manhattan, lived in the family penthouse, was attending a private school there. But the stories he would tell, and that I heard also from his sister Liz, kind of sounded like he was on his own. You know, Rupert, to a certain extent, was almost like a celebrity when he would come back to visit New York, right? Like, James would recall him walking in his double-breasted suits with, you know, a gaggle of employees in tow, and he seemed important and this big kind of larger-than-life figure. And he did try to bring his kids into his business, which really does seem like it was Rupert's whole world, right? He would bring his kids, take them on tours of the printing presses of his newspapers, and he would get them internships at his newspapers. He would bring, you know, politicians and dignitaries to dinner. There is a story that often gets told in profiles and biographies of Rupert that at breakfast, he would lay all the newspapers out over the table and kind of take his kids through the various editorial decisions that had been made to craft the newspapers and critique them, almost like a master class for, you know, future media moguls. James told me that that did happen sometimes, but it wasn't a regular occurrence because he didn't have breakfast with his dad all that often. And so I think that captures sort of James's experience, at least, with his dad growing up.
And what about James's early career? So you described him as a bit of a rebel, perhaps, in his college-aged years. At some point, though, he does get folded back into the family business. What were those years like?
His dad made it happen by buying the hip-hop label that James started with his buddies and folded it into the family business. James actually spent 20 years kind of climbing the ladder in the Murdoch empire. He went and ran a struggling Asian satellite business that was owned by his father, turned it around. It turned out that James actually had kind of a talent for corporate leadership. He then moved to London to run Sky Broadcasting for a while, had some success there, was promoted to eventually become the chief executive of all of the Murdoch's Europe and Asia operations. And at some point in all of this, Lachlan, the older brother, actually took himself out of the succession running for a while. He quit in 2005, moved back to Australia. So for a while, Rupert thought James was going to be kind of the heir to all of this.
And what had Lachlan been doing up until that point?
Lachlan had been in New York, basically apprenticing under the chief operating officer, basically essentially being groomed to take over the business.
Right.
But he found himself getting into various turf wars with other executives at the company, Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, most notably among them. And Lachlan felt like his dad didn't have his back, would often side with the other executives, and he eventually resigned and moved back to Australia. But that's important because James, when he became the heir apparent, it changed the nature of his relationship with his dad in important ways. Like, James started to really come into his own, started to try to establish some independence from his father. He didn't want to look like, you know, a boy trying on his dad's sport coat. He wanted to kind of be his own man.
Well, it also sounds like he was always struggling, James, to win some shred of approval from his father, that in all of these successes that he did have rising through the ranks, it didn't seem to really impress Rupert very much. Or if it did, he didn't show it.
Well, and if anything, I think it might have created more distance between them, because the dirty little secret of the succession battle was that Rupert never wanted to retire, right? Even as he got into his 70s and 80s, and now he's, you know, he's in his early 90s, he constantly showed no willingness to step back. He hated giving any control to his sons. He hated the idea of being eclipsed by his sons, right? And so because of that, when James started to have success, I think that Rupert actually experienced that more as a threat to his own power and standing, more than, you know, him being kind of a proud father. One of Rupert's biographers in 2008 interviewed Rupert and all of his kids at this time. This was when James was really on the rise. And he observed this kind of strange dynamic where he said, Rupert is obviously proud of James, but also seems afraid of him. And I think that eventually would end up kind of spelling the demise of their relationship.
Interesting. Well, another important, it sounds like, and formative experience for James was meeting his wife, the woman who became his wife, Catherine. Tell us a little bit more about Catherine and how she became a force in the family dynamic.
Yeah, so James and Catherine met when they were pretty young, in their 20s, and got married fairly quickly. And Catherine's more left-leaning politics definitely were viewed with suspicion within the family, especially by Rupert, who came to this belief that his daughter-in-law had, like, hypnotized James and was kind of indoctrinating him with her fashionable lefty politics. The truth, according to both James and Catherine, is that James was always more moderate and that Catherine's views are more complicated than Rupert ever believed. Nonetheless, you know, she was an environmentalist. She went to work for the Clinton Climate Initiative. She was certainly viewed by people at Fox News as kind of a menace, you know. Catherine was really an interesting figure in the reporting of this piece because she also had the clarity of an outsider who came into the family and kind of observed these family dynamics in a way that James had a harder time understanding because he had just grown up with them, you know. I remember at one point James saying, you know, I never really felt like I was pitted against my brother until later in life. And Catherine said, oh, but I saw it all the time. You know, your dad was constantly comparing you to, trying to get you to compete for his approval and affection. And I think that while early on she loved, her in-laws, she actually had a lot of affection for Rupert. But I think over time, as she saw what happened to her husband and the way that Rupert crafted what she saw as kind of a toxic dynamic within the family, she started to become more outspoken. And I think she probably helped James see things that he hadn't seen before.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to this rivalry between Lachlan and James. I mean, another thing, I know you mentioned James is the youngest, but they're only 15 months apart, right? They're very close in age.
That's right. They were treated almost like twins when they were younger. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of funny that Lachlan was always assumed that he was going to be the heir, right? Because he's older. I mean,
just by barely being older.
Exactly.
Well, not only that, though, it does sound like Lachlan was more willing to be in step with his dad from a younger age and go through the grooming process, perhaps in a way that James was not so open to, at least not right away.
I think that's right. I think he was really, from an early age, kind of a mini Rupert. And so he kind of leaned into the successor role. James, I think because he was always seen as, to put it kind of crassly, the spare, he actually was able at an early age to carve out more of his own identity. Eventually, James and Lachlan ended up running the business together. This is in 2015, 2016. Lachlan was brought back into the company after James had been there for a long time. And James was CEO, Lachlan was executive chairman. And they basically were presented to the world as co-successors. They would be co-running this company together. Mm-hmm. And that's where the rivalry, I really think, came to a head, because it became clear very quickly to James, at least, that this arrangement was not really going to work. Every major decision had to be signed off by both of them. They had very different views of how the company should be run. They didn't communicate well. They were based on opposite coasts. James felt that Lachlan kind of bristled at any suggestion that James was the more seasoned executive. And they just really did not get along.
And it also sounds like there were political forces at play that they just felt differently about fundamentally. I mean, this was the beginning of the Trump years. Mm-hmm. Are there any examples that you can think of that illustrate the ways in which these two brothers were at odds?
Yeah, that was the other important thing that was happening here, is that the Trump era was beginning and it was coming to define certainly the Murdoch's American news outlets. And James and Lachlan had very different views of Donald Trump and how their outlets were kind of championing his presidency. There were two key moments that underscored the division. One came early in 2017 when Trump signed his executive order banning travel from several majority Muslim countries to the United States. James was appalled by the travel ban. He also felt that as the CEO of this international company, he should release kind of a company-wide memo seeking to reassure their Muslim employees, stating their opposition to this policy, saying, you know, we're going to do everything we can to work around this and work with you, and you should know that we have your backs, right? Lachlan was opposed to this. He thought that there was no reason for them to put out a company-wide memo like that. And if they were going to put out a memo, they shouldn't even mention Trump or his policy at all. Lachlan probably understood that, you know, Fox News was every night fiercely defending the travel ban and the Trump White House in general, and that maybe there would be some kind of dissonance there. Because they were co-chief executives, they both had to sign off on the language of this memo. And there was this kind of endless tug of war over the language. And by the time it was finally put out, it had been pretty severely watered down, and James wasn't happy with it. And so he took a lesson from that, which was, I'm not going to have an ally in my brother when it comes to this stuff. Mm. So several months later, when white supremacists marched through the streets of Charlottesville chanting, Jews will not replace us, James once again found himself wondering, should we put out some memo? Should we, you know, make clear where we stand on this? But he knew that Lachlan and Rupert would be annoyed by it, right? And they'd be like, oh my gosh, here we go again with pious, nagging, liberal James trying to shove his politics in everybody's face. And so he actually considered just kind of letting it drop. It was Catherine who finally kind of asked a clarifying question to James, which was, if you're not going to stand up to Nazis, who are you going to stand up against? And for him, that was an important moment. And he decided that he would just circumvent the whole approval process and put out his own personal statement. And he did that, and he donated $1 million to the Anti-Defamation League and encouraged, you know, others to donate. And that was, I think, interpreted by Rupert and Lachlan as an act of disloyalty by him. And I think it was kind of the beginning of the end of this kind of co-leadership arrangement.
Well, help me understand the ideological motivations here for everyone involved. I mean, James told you that when his father came to support Donald Trump's candidacy for president, that he was surprised by how quickly his father seemed to abandon his principles.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about his father that James didn't seem to understand?
I think that it's important to understand that, like, in addition to, you know, having worked in this company for a long time, James also saw Rupert as his dad. James had always believed that his dad had like a core set of values and principles that motivated him. That yes, Rupert's media outlets were known for being sort of puckish and mischievous and trollish, but he believed that beneath all the kind of anti-establishment posturing, there was a set of beliefs motivating these news outlets. And while both Rupert and Trump were ostensibly conservatives, they had very different brands of conservatism. And James hoped, kind of idealistically perhaps, that Rupert would use these media outlets early on to push back on Trump, right? And according to James, Rupert did actually early on oppose Trump. And he told James that if Trump won the Republican nomination in 2016, it would be the end of the Republican Party. But then Rupert realized pretty quickly that Trump played with their audiences, right? That the Fox News audience in particular loved Trump. And more broadly, that their conservative customers were really responding to Trump. And almost overnight, Rupert pivoted. And all of a sudden, these outlets were fiercely defending Trump. They were running op-eds and editorials defending him. And once Trump was elected, you know, Rupert was meeting with Trump and his, you know, administration officials, and the outlets were relentlessly championing his presidency. And for James, this was all really disheartening and disillusioning because it made him realize that his dad really was not motivated by any kind of set of principles or ideas. He was just motivated by power and profit. And that, I think, was demoralizing for James.
Well, I mean, to the point of profit making, it also sounds like James fundamentally disagreed with a lot of these choices because he also thought that they weren't good for business in the end. I mean, we saw how the defamation suit ended between Fox and Dominion Voting Systems. Huge settlement. They reached, I believe it was $787 million settlement over lies that Fox broadcast on the air about Dominion voting and the outcome of the 2020 election. How did James and his father not see eye to eye on things like that, that James would argue are actually bad for business in the end?
That's right. And I think this is a key point. It's become a central question in this litigation over the family trust, because Rupert is essentially arguing, if James is allowed to have his way when I'm gone, he'll tank the value of the company by, you know, moderating its politics and turning our backs on our conservative audiences, right? What James says is that the way these companies have been run is actually really bad for business. And his argument is, Fox News, for example, could still be a right-leaning network. It could report from a conservative perspective. It could have conservative commentary on air. But if it was run more responsibly, we never would have been in a position where we're paying out these massive defamation settlements. His argument is that it's not only the right thing to do to not broadcast obvious lies on air, but it's also the financially prudent one.
Well, take us up to 2023, which is when it sounds like Rupert decided to change the trust and decided that it was important to him to make sure that Lachlan was in full control. What was his strategy in getting his kids on board with his plan?
Well, Lachlan was already obviously on board, right? Rupert and Lachlan and a kind of small circle of executives and lawyers drafted this plan that they codenamed Project Family Harmony, which may go down as one of the all-time most euphemistic titles for a project like this.
Are you sure that wasn't a Succession episode? Project Family Harmony? That sounds very written.
Exactly. So late in 2023, Rupert gathered his adult children on Zoom and basically announced his decision to them. And James and Elizabeth and Prudence were completely blindsided, had no sense that this was happening, and really shocked by the decision. They felt like this was their father deciding that he favored one of his children over the others, taking away what they saw as their inheritance that they were entitled to. And it was also, in a sense, a betrayal of Rupert's ex-wife, Anna, who is the mother to James, Lachlan, and Elizabeth, because this arrangement in the trust was actually at Anna's insistence. She gave up a lot of the money that she was entitled to in the divorce in exchange for an arrangement that would guarantee that control of the family business would be split equally among the children. Mm. She thought that this would be a way to incentivize cooperation among the kids and maybe to blunt any effort that Rupert made to kind of play them against each other. And as it turns out, obviously, it didn't work out that way.
McKay, your piece for The Atlantic opens with this scene in a law office in Manhattan that really shows just how broken James and his father's relationship has become. And it really stuck with me. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. It took place last year at a law office in Manhattan where James was showing up to be deposed in this lawsuit that was taking place over the Murdoch Family Trust. And it's important to understand at this point, James is basically estranged from his father. He hadn't talked to him in years. They had barely been in the same room. And he sits down across this big conference table, and sitting across from him is a lawyer who is there to basically grill him for several hours. And sitting next to that lawyer is Rupert. And for the next several hours, the lawyer just hurls like withering personal questions at James, like, have you ever done anything successful on your own? Mm. Isn't it true that you never take responsibility for your actions? And even things like, why didn't you call your father on his 90th birthday? And throughout this whole deposition, James keeps looking over at his dad, who's just kind of staring inscrutably at his son, not saying a word. And every once in a while, he's picking up his phone. And eventually it dawns on James that Rupert is texting these questions to his lawyer to ask his son. And that episode really stuck with James for a long time. And he kind of couldn't believe that it had come to this.
Jeez. You know, there's another memorable anecdote that you tell in your piece, which happened around Thanksgiving last year. James, Prudence, and Elizabeth write this note to their father, trying to extend an olive branch of sorts. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about how that note was received?
Yeah, Thanksgiving was approaching. The trial was over, but the judge, the probate commissioner, who was going to be ruling on all of this, had not made their decision. Mm-hmm. And James and his sisters felt pretty good about what was going to happen. They thought they had the stronger case. Their lawyers were pretty confident. But they had this kind of moment of weakness, this like, you know, almost sentimental moment. You know, the holidays were coming up. They were kind of anguished about the estrangement that they now had with half their family. And they thought that there might be an opportunity to basically reach out to their dad and say, look, let's put our weapons down. You withdraw your proposed amendment. We'll drop our legal challenge. And let's see if we can talk things out as a family. And so James and his sisters wrote this personal letter to Rupert and basically said that. And a couple days later, Rupert wrote back and said, I've reviewed all of your testimony. I've reread it. I'm more convinced than ever that I'm right. And if you want to talk, talk to my lawyer.
Mm. And the sign-off was much love, Dad.
Yes.
Right.
Well, as you can imagine, not a lot of love felt in that letter, at least from James's perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this sort of similar sign-off appeared in a few places, right, where it's just a cold business as usual, love, Dad. Mm-hmm. It reminded me a lot of the Succession line, that very famous moment where Logan Roy says to his kids, I love you, but you're not serious people.
Totally. And I think that it also just gets at, like, how intertwined the professional always has been with the personal in this stuff with the Murdochs. Like, I remember asking James at one point about actually a family counseling retreat that Rupert summoned all the kids to in Australia in 2010. And I said, so was the idea that you were going to work out business stuff or personal stuff? And he said, in this family, there's no difference.
Mm. What is your impression now, having spent all this time speaking to James and delving into this family history? What exactly is Rupert Murdoch's legacy in his mind? And what do you think it is in actuality? Are they the same thing?
It's a good question. I mean, I think he sees himself as having built this incredibly successful and influential media empire across multiple continents that stands apart from the rest of the media establishment. And it's hard to know how he will be remembered. I think a lot of it depends, frankly, on how some of the political events that he helped put into place will play out. But, you know, it's easy to see a situation where 20, 30, 50 years from now, he's seen as being somebody who seeded the breakup of Europe. You know, his newspapers championed Brexit, the upending of the liberal international order, and, you know, depending on how things play out in this second Trump term and beyond, the kind of backsliding of American democracy. Time will tell how history remembers him, but I think that one of the hard things for his kids to wrap their heads around is that at the end of the day, in the family media empire, Rupert has always prioritized the empire over the family. That's what he cares about most.
And I mean, Rupert Murdoch is 93 years old now. Of course, as we know, the trust has remained unchanged. These four kids will have to coordinate in some way when Rupert Murdoch dies to decide how to move ahead. What do you see as the possible outcomes here?
There are a number of scenarios, right? I mean, if it turns out that there is basically a 3-1 dynamic, right, with James and his sisters on one side, Lachlan on the other, you could see big changes at places like Fox News. You could see new executives being brought in to modernize, professionalize, change the culture. You could also see a scenario where there's a dismantling of the empire, that basically the outlets are sold off in pieces to various other companies and that the Murdoch media empire is no more. It's really hard to know. And this was always an area that James was really kind of cagey about because it's the subject of active litigation. But, you know, it's not hard to kind of read the tea leaves and see a number of scenarios that would, frankly, probably upset Rupert if they were to take place.
Yeah, it's also difficult to talk about what should happen next when a person like Rupert Murdoch is so, it sounds, unwilling to imagine a world in which he is gone, really.
Right. This is not to bring back Classics Hour with James Murdoch, but this was one of the most revealing moments for me. He told me once about this book he'd read, Memoirs of Hadrian, a kind of fictionalized version of the second century Roman emperor Hadrian. And in this passage, Hadrian is kind of encountering a dying emperor who's refusing to face his end. And he's looking for an heir who will kind of extend his own immortality, right? Who will make all the same decisions that he would and make all the same mistakes. And that in that way, the emperor will be able to kind of extend his reach beyond the grave. And James feels like that's really where his father is at, that his father just can't accept the fact that he's going to die and that the world will exist without him, and is trying to make it so that his kind of replica, his mini-me, will be the one to continue to run things after he's gone and in some way Rupert will feel like he's still there.
Mm. McKay, thank you so much for this reporting, for bringing us this perspective.
Thanks for having me.
McKay Coppins is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His feature, Growing Up Murdoch, was Apple News' February Story of the Month. We'll link to it in our show notes page. And if you're listening in the Apple News app, we'll cue it up to play for you next.